Hello, spooky friends. I have put together some of the most spooky and scary tales of my guest on Dairyland Frights. So sit back and be scared.
Here's one spooky story I can share with all.
Oh my God, I have so many spooky stories. I'm going to tell you, I've told my UFO ones. I'm going to try not to tell that one right now. Okay. People sick of it. But I'm going to tell one that I actually had, and I have no, I don't know what it was or what ended up happening, but I'm going to tell you how it happened. I moved into one of these like manufactured home communities years ago when my parents divorced. I was pretty young. I was possibly like 20 something. I don't know, my 20s. And I was living with my mom and my sister. Everything was cool. And our home was in front of a lake, but behind us was a lake. In front of us was a landfill. So it wasn't like the best place to live, but it's what my mom could afford at that time and what we can do. But anyway, that's like beyond the point. The point is manufactured home, not, you know, the best quality home sort of stuff. So it was very easy to hear things all the time, especially outside and stuff. And my room was the first room. As soon as like when you walked into the door, my room was to the left. So I was the first room of the house, let's say. And my window looked toward the road. Well, a couple nights I start waking up hearing these very deep, guttural sort of breathing, heavy breathing noises. And that, like, I was like, what in hell is, what is outside? I had never heard of anything like that before. And I mean, I'm like a nature person. I used to like trek the Everglades all the time. I know what a lot of these animals that we have around here sounds like and stuff, right? So like, I was just like, okay, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
And I remember one night hearing it, and it sounded like it was almost like dragging itself across my window, like from on the floor. And I was just like, I am terrified. Like I froze. I was like, I'm terrified. I don't even want to know what that is. So I never looked.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just like, whatever. A few days pass, maybe months. I really don't know. The timeline's all blurred at this point, right? I just know that another day I woke up to something, again, making weird noises. But this time it threw a rock at my window and I hear the rock break toward the window. And I was like, oh, shit.
Oh, no.
I was like, oh, shit. Like, I was what is going on? And at that point, I'm like, I'm going to ignore it. Like, I'm going to pretend like it's not even there. But as soon as I'm like, I'm going to try to shake this off. Like, nothing happened. Nothing broke. You understand?
Yeah.
As soon as I said that, I hear these clap, like these taps. Like it was, and I will never forget how it sounded because it was very short and very quick. It was ba, 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 ba. And I'm like, what the heck is that? So it just sounded like,
yeah. What the hell?
Yeah. It wasn't galloping because galloping is more like da da. Da 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 da. This wasn't that. And I'm like, oh my God. So the next morning, I'm like, no, I gotta investigate. I don't know if I'm hearing things or this is like sleep hallucinations or whatever. So I grab my sister. I remember grabbing my sister, and we had just painted our home. So our house is freshly painted and our driveway is freshly painted. So I go outside and I see the rock on my window, like on the floor. It's still there, broken in pieces. And it was a relatively like nice shaped, like big sized rock. So I was like, okay, well, that's weird. It couldn't have just been kicked up. Do you understand? Like something had to throw it. But the the freakiest thing, I will never know what it was it left a half moon shaped footmark, a mark on my fresh paint. And it just looked like a little new moon, like a little like crescent moon sort of like, but I don't know.
Wow.
It was the weirdest thing. And we were all looking, my sister and I kind of looked at each other and she was like,
that is weird.
What was that? And I was like, I don't know. And I told her everything. And ever since then, like we never heard or saw anything again, but that was pretty terrifying.
That's a good one.
Yeah,
that's a good one. You're braver than me to go outside. I imagine you did it in the light of day.
Oh, yeah, the next morning. Heck no, I wasn't going out.
Right?
No.
Okay. I was like, no. Deborah, what are you doing? Going in the dark? Are you crazy?
Nope.
Come on, have you seen a horror movie?
I know rules. I need to be a final girl, okay? It's not happening.
All right. Okay. So you're going to die last.
For sure.
That's good to know. If we're ever in a situation, I can count on Deborah. Awesome. So, Vera, do you have a favorite or spooky personal paranormal experience you would like to share with us?
Oh, definitely. Of course. I mean, I will to go back to my cave here that I investigate. Nice. And we'll just say that a lot of events ended up tragic from me investigating the cave, as in I lost 3 chickens because something took them. Don't know if they're killed, but took them because there was no blood. You know, all there was feathers. And that's a whole other story. But when I did investigate the cave a few months ago, and 3 different mediums from 3 different states who do not know each other, I was in there and they had watched a video, they had said that they had seen like a skinwalker type that's in the cave. And I've actually caught a very dark black shadow manifesting from an inky blob to a vertical, human or vertical figure, I should say, because I say it's human because I don't know. But a lot of experiences here have really opened my eyes. They've been more of the negative, evil kind of entity. What it said is that there was a shaman that thousands of years ago, like maybe 1,000, 2,000 years ago, had banished some of the Indians that lived here because they were delving into magic that was not good, of course, for the tribe. And so they were banished as skinwalkers in the cave, and they are trying to get me to let them out. That's how it was said to me.
That's amazing, you know, because obviously you're familiar with Skinwalker Ranch, correct?
Of course. And my place has been pretty much, because I have UFO activity here, Bigfoot activity here. Like, there is a supposed Sasquatch pod that lives around this property. I've caught the Bigfoot howl on an EVP recorder session before, which, you know, if you go on my Instagram, go toward like the beginning of when I started my Instagram for the Conversation Cabin, and there you'll find I've posted a lot of the evidence that I've gathered. Again, this is why I started doing it, because I don't know about you, John, but aren't you tired of like when you tell someone that you saw something or you took a picture of something and they say, well, that's not what it is. But then you ask, okay, well, then tell me what it is. And they can't.
Right.
So then I went out there and found my own answers. But again, when I went into the cave the next day, that's when I lost 2 more chickens. So something in there was trying to give me a clue, like, do not come into my place or I'm going to come out to your place. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And that is absolutely fine. Fascinating, because I don't know, here in Wisconsin, our main cryptid is called the Beast of Bray Road.
Very much about that.
Yeah. So it's like a werewolf creature. I talked to the owner of American Ghost Walks on one of our episodes, and he said that, again, you know, nobody knows what this thing is. It could be an interdimensional being. It could be, you know, some cursed skinwalker. It could be a number of different things. And one of the things he told me, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but he said, when he was out, he was at this barn and he was a kid and, you know, stupid. He has one of those deserted barns in the middle of nowhere, you know, and cliche scary barns in horror movies, and went in there and there were all these chicken bones all over this barn, in the walls, on the floor, everywhere. And he was like, how's that, you know, is some kids do that for fun, or is this, you know? And this was in that area too. And people have found, like you said, chicken bones on this area, but no one is really get definitive proof of that. But and it's hard to explain, right? It's hard to say, like, well, it's a werewolf. Oh, okay, I get you. Sure, it is. Kind of attitude,
right?
And you know, there are things out there like that. You know, it's just hard to prove to somebody who are extremely skeptical about.
Have a picture of a dog man. What looks like a dog man, and you know, it's actually several times. We have a very strong smell that comes through our air conditioner that's in the bedroom of a very, urine, very, very strong urine, like, you know, three barrels of urine has been dumped right beside our air conditioner, and it's just flooding into our house. So we have some different, you know, activity like that as well. And you're right. You know, the one thing that, you know, everybody wants to see that holy grail, but these beings are, you know, I've talked with the best researchers. I've talked with Nick Valente, who is the founder of the International Dogman Project. Jessica Jones, the Cryptid Hunters, who is like a boots on the ground researcher. And I can tell you from, you know, talking to Nick and Jessica and some other friends of mine that are Bigfoot Dogman kind of cryptid researchers that there's something out there. It's the fact that you have to, many people have to start or stop thinking that they're just flesh and blood. They are some sort of supernatural as well. So then that is the way that they are able to stay elusive. They can travel through different portals, you know, from different corners of the world. And, you know, we just cannot be so closed-minded, narrow-minded to think that we're the only living kind of species, humanoid creatures in this entire cosmos. There's just no way. And when you look at what we do to each other on a daily basis, this can't be all that there is, because then if there is, then someone did something awful because you just don't treat people the way that we see the negativity, you know, being spread. And, you know, it's so easy to divide us. So, again, there has to be other things.
This was back in, you know, 2009. This would have been like iPhone 1 era. So a lot of people still had regular, not Polaroids, but regular 35 millimeter printouts. And he showed me this printout of on the main level in one of those corner towers, this wispy apparition of what looked like a man. And this is sounds so cliche. And if somebody told me this, I'd call them, say, you're full of shit. But it looked like a man in a fedora holding a Tommy gun in this wispy apparition. And this was before, you know, modern day, you know, where it's easy to like Photoshop and print something out. Like somebody actually captured this. And I was very intrigued by that. And I wish I had known what happened to that photo, because shortly after, I moved out of that apartment. It was renovated and turned into the Wonder Bar. And it's unfortunate that I think it was a casualty of COVID. And if you're a Madisonian, you know, there are a lot of people looking to move to the Madison area. They want to live in the downtown. They want to live by Lake Monona, Lake Mendota. Yeah. And they are tearing things down as fast as they're building it. And this is one of the sites. Yes, it's a shame, because we need to keep Madison weird, and we need to protect some of this historical heritage and not just make everything high-rise apartments. That's kind of my screed for the evening. But it's one of the places that has been on the list of places to tear down and redevelop. And it'd really be a shame, because it's, you know, I have a personal connection to it, because it was, you know, the first bar that I went to when I came to Madison. And
Me too.
And it just has such a rich history of, you know, gangster lore to haunting. So it like checks all over the boxes for me. And if it went away, which I assume it probably will be moved and reconstructed somewhere, if we're lucky, if not raised. But if it is knocked down, I'm going to have to go grab a brick or something like that for a memento, because it was a great place. And And it's great. So
yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have the best news about that one, but definitely an awesome place with lots of history and legends.
So what do you think of the list? Is there anything you would add? Is there anything, John, you missed this one?
The one that I would add is we're talking about the Poor Farm, the Wood County Asylum. Let's talk about the Sheboygan Asylum. It's just outside of Sheboygan. The Fox Valley Ghost Hunters, the same group that I went to Summerwind with, they run tours there. And I got a chance to, about a year ago, to visit. And it has a similar history to the Wood County Asylum, but it sounds like the treatments weren't as horrific. It sounds like they treated their patients a little bit better. So at least that's what they tell you on the ghost hunt. So I hope that's true.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of activity there. There is one little room they call the chapel where, the tour guides kind of, the way that the Fox Valley Ghost Hunters tours work is a lot of times you go on these ghost hunts and they'll just be like a tour guide that will walk you through and tell you like a scary story. With the Fox Valley Ghost Hunters, they're ghost hunters at heart. So they will bring all of their gadgets and gizmos. Sure. And they will try to involve the group in a group ghost hunt. And, we had the EVP, or not the EVP rope, the EMF rope laid out with the little lights on it. And whenever something gets near and changes the EMF, it changes the colors. We got so much activity in that room and lots of spirit box activity. We got to visit that chapel. We got to visit there was like a cold storage for the bodies. We got to go into that room and conduct a seance. We got to go into some steam tunnels and had just an incredible experience with the spirit box session there. So anybody who wants a little thrill, I would definitely recommend the Sheboygan County Asylum. And the Great Lakes Paracon is coming up next month.
And lo and behold, bam. During that sickness must have been when it attached to me. Mm-hmm. So as we drove away from the cemetery, I started feeling better and better and better. And finally, we got about 3 miles away. I was fine.
Yeah.
So over the next month, something was tormenting my daughter. She was seeing a shadow in the room every night. Larry and I tried to film it. I called him immediately and told him what was going on. Mysteriously, the camera that I would set up kept getting turned off. And I had a pretty new son in the house at the time.
Okay.
So, we decided that, it was an attachment. And when it really showed itself to me, and I'm empathic. So, I'm not sensitive, I'm not psychic, but I'm empathic. Okay. And sometimes, little things get thrown into the back of my head from spirits, a name or a phrase or something or a feeling.
Right.
I was standing outside and I was talking to my good friend Tom, and he was from Massachusetts and he ran a team out there. And I was telling Tom, Tom, there's something in my house. And I was standing in my backyard, and my kids had a swing set, and there was two swings. All of a sudden, John, one of them started moving and picking up speed. And then it stopped abruptly, and I'm telling Tom what's going on, and all of a sudden, in my head, I can hear, I'm going to do what I want around your daughter, and there's not a damn thing you can do to stop me.
Oh, no. Oh, wow.
So what I'm getting at is it's hard enough to fight something, and it's really hard when you can't see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Larry and I enlisted a friend of ours who's a psychic, and enlisted another friend of ours who I'm not going to mention their names because the one psychic who actually helped us do this does not want to have to do this anymore. So,
gotcha. Yeah, that's
she, you know, she has to remain nameless in the whole thing. But
yeah,
Larry and I performed a cleansing in the house.
Good.
And it was the most wild thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. Prior to this, you know, our interactions with people with juju powers are extremely limited. We're just a bunch of fat dudes that like to kill them.
Part of the big issue up here is we have a lot of limestone. We are an escarpment. It's part of the Niagara escarpment. But that limestone continues out of the bluffs down underwater. And so there's a lot of, you know, a lot of hazards and a lot of reefs and shoals that you need to avoid. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know how to navigate the area, you can get in a lot of trouble. And Death's Door happened to be, you know, that was like the doorway into Green Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually named by the French after they had found the evidence of a Native American battle that occurred up there.
Mm.
And they had found so many skeletons that had been washed up on the beaches of that area. And they heard stories for the few witnesses that were still alive when they came through.
Yeah.
That's when they named it La Porte de Mort. And the British translation of that was Death's Door. And that was actually the suggestion to actually name our county Death's Door County at one point.
Right.
Luckily, we were a long, thin county, and that didn't all fit on the map. Well, Death's Door is exciting. And there's a shipwreck story I do tell that's very apropos to that situation.
Yes. Yeah, and we'll get into this, a lot of the different stories here. So I have to ask you this, Ed. Before you started doing the tours, were you interested in the paranormal? Did you believe in ghosts? Or did your mind change once you started doing the tours?
Well, I wasn't all in on the whole ghost thing. I was very skeptical about all of it. And just not a non-believer, but somebody who was very intrigued by it and kind of hoping, you know, that boy, it'd be neat to have this experience to really confirm my beliefs, but never real, always skeptical thing.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until that date in it was right after August 21st of 2017, when that solar eclipse occurred, that we had just an explosion of facial images that people were taking. We had prior to that, I mean, there might have been four or five in a week's time. And we do these tours. We start on Memorial Day weekend. We go every night of the week, seven nights a week, all the way through Halloween and some years after, depending on what the demand is.
Mm.
And we have a minimum of two trolleys per night. And we're going at it heavy duty. And all of a sudden, you know, we're getting four to five per week of these images, not the explosion that occurred after that solar eclipse. All of a sudden, we're getting 14 to 18 per tour.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody taking pictures on the tour was getting a facial images.
Yeah.
Different windows. And so I'm thinking, what's going on here? You know, is it the fact iPhones are just getting better? You know, they're getting their quality, more of the imperfections in the windows. What's going on here? So I snapped a picture of every single window in that house about 3 days after the 21st. That'd be put me about August 24th.
Okay.
And when I got home that night, I opened up all the pictures I did, and the very first one I took was the very best facial image I have ever seen coming out of that.
Of magic and so forth. So many magic workers avoid the terms entirely. So, Cynthia, do you and not even bring that up when people ask you?
When people ask me, "Are you or do you black by magic?"
Yeah, right.
That's interesting, but I can't answer that specifically because brother, I told you some things I do is white magic, and sometimes I do black magic, but never to harm other people. And the kind of black magic I do is, I think, work with demons. And for me, it's not black magic, but it's a subject from the black magic.
Mm-hmm.
If you search that on Google in the books, it's always black magic, black pact, pacts with the devil. But it's also, what are you doing with that?
Sure.
A little while ago, I had a new book, and it's about satanic rituals. So I think, oh, that's nice. And I'm going to read that episode, and there it's saying for you must kill a goat and drink his blood.
Okay.
Oh, I don't do that.
Yeah.
and people think that that's it, black magic, satanic magic, Luciferian magic. That's what they do. They offer animals mm-hmm. or people, and they drink blood, and that's not how it works. Being a satanic witch or a satanist is the magic word in that is freedom. And everywhere it's you must do this, you must do that. And that's not in the satanic Bible. Mm-hmm. You must do what you want.
Correct.
As long as you don't harm any other people.
Yes.
And be what you want.
I love that.
I think a lot of people love that because I know the Satanic Temple. I'm a member of the Satanic Temple. And there is a high priester or the of the Satanic Temple in Salem. And he is gay. And he say, in the church, nobody except me. And here, with the Satanic Temple, I can be myself. I can do what I want. People accept me for who I am and what I am.
Yeah.
And that's, I call it freedom. And that's the key word in, the satanic, witchcraft and the satanic, church and the Bible, freedom. And, that's, I love that kind of, of the satanism.
Yes. And again,
always talk about the witches and stuff like that. Well, like I said, they've done some of the research to find out, okay, how did that start? And that's kind of what the spirit tour kind of walks you through. It takes you to some of these locations that are, some of these legends and lore, and you actually get a lot more of the truth of the historical part of how that came about. Oh, definitely. I'll let you talk about Mary Worth, okay. Dave.
Well, I first heard about Mary Worth from Lizzie Wright, the town historian. And she said that Mary Worth was a self-proclaimed witch. And so the legends of Mary Worth are, you hear Mary everywhere, about throughout the United States. And Whitewater, it seems to be kind of the focal point of where Mary Worth maybe existed. We haven't found her grave yet. We've heard lots of stories about where she may be buried. The legend here is that Mary, when she came to the end of her life and was quite ill, she said she wanted to be buried in Hillside Cemetery. And the local managers there, the board said that, no, you can't be buried in hallowed ground. So we won't allow a witch to be buried in our hallowed cemetery. And she said, if you don't bury me there, I'll curse this whole city. So the legend says that they put her in an above ground crypt. She wasn't buried in hallowed ground. She was above ground. So a loophole. So she may be there. We don't know. There are two crypts, actually more than that, just three crypts, but there's two crypts that are fairly well known now in Hillside. One is called the public crypt, which was the temporary holding vault for bodies during the winter. It was too difficult to dig graves in the wintertime. They didn't have the big machinery they have now. So they would put them in cold storage, basically an above ground crypt called the public crypt. And there are racks inside the crypt, which are still there. And we'll get to see.
And you do get to see those on the tour.
Yeah.
And going,
the crypt is open. Yes, uh-huh. The crypt is open for the tour.
Yep. So that we would store bodies and would probably hold a dozen or so, I guess, coffins there. So in the springtime, when the ground thawed, then they would dig, the graves and put them in their final resting, graves. But right next door to it is another crypt, and it's kind of a mysterious one. And we aren't quite sure what happened there. But when I was in school here in the 70s, in about 1971, there was a break-in of that crypt. And vandals had destroyed some of the coffins and scattered bones of those that were in those coffins in that crypt. And they also took one of the, there was a baby coffin there that they removed from there and took it over to campus and put it in the fountain. I was going to class and I saw this gathering of people around the fountain, and there was this baby coffin in the fountain. So the police came then and took it back and replaced it back into the proper crypt. And then the gates to that crypt, the doorways were welded shut. They didn't want anybody breaking into it again. So a terrible thing to happen to desecrate the graves, but or desecrate the, you know, their, the resting place of those people. And there's a few coffins still in there. But anyway, so the legend was that Mary Worth was buried in that crypt. We don't know that for a fact, but you know, it's kind of mysterious that there aren't too many records about Mary Worth. The census of what, 1895?
Yeah,
1890. Yeah. The census was burned in a fire, so the records were lost. So that whole census was lost in the fire.
Well, it doesn't help with the fact that that crypt also, the top of it, where normally you would see like a family name and stuff, is all kind of been sandblasted off.
And I think I remember when I was in there before this happened, was when I was looking at, looking for grave sites, historical grave sites. I remember that crypt very well. And the inscription on top of the crypt was pretty plain. After that crypt was broken into, that was removed. I think people to obscure it so people wouldn't know where to look, you know, for Mary Worth. So called the Morgan Crypt.
I can't say it was specifically Mary Worth that we were trying to conjure. That was 35 years ago, and it might have been after a partaking a little bit that evening. A few spirits myself. But yes, did the Ouija board near the cemetery on campus. And doing the Ouija board there and in a couple of apartments when I was in college, it really freaked me out because the answers that you get were way too accurate. And I haven't done the since. So I wouldn't say the cornfield was necessarily connected to Mary Worth. It was just, I just remember as a freshman, you know, that was one of the things they'd try to scare you with, you know, because the campus butts up right at that point, right up to farm fields. And that was always the legend, was that the cornfield just on the north end of campus, that you couldn't go across it. You couldn't make it all the way through from one end to the other on Halloween. Yet the spirits would get you. The children. That might have been before Children of the Corn.
Not really that I've, because I've actually delved into, I couldn't tell you how many records here and still do. The amount of rabbit holes I go down is scary, I'll tell you that. But I haven't found anything that even says anything like that.
No, I think Mary Worth is pretty well known in this town. The legend of Mary Worth is pretty common. But there was no trial. I think the records of her have been just lost.
Yeah.
If there was a real person of Mary Worth, there's no record of her. I remember speaking to a elderly person. I won't mention his name, but he was the chairman of the cemetery committee at the time, years ago. and we talked about Mary Worth. He said, you don't want to talk about her. And I kept pressing him for more information. And he said, is she buried there at Hillside? And he said, we don't talk about that. And then he finally said, she's been removed.
Or relocated.
Relocated. And that was it. Don't want to talk anymore about it. So very mysterious.
We ventured up to the water tower and we decided that we were going to jump the fence and go in. And So at that point, it was just more like a chain link fence. And at the top, you had barbed wire, but it was pointed in. So, you know, most places have barbed wire that's pointed out to try to keep you from getting in. Well, this was tipped inward, so it was almost like it was trying to keep something from getting out from inside. And had it not been one of my shoelaces catching on the barbed wire, I might have wound up inside the gate that night. A friend of mine did, and again, this could have been maybe alcohol-induced, but he was trying to climb out a couple of times. We were trying to help him out, and he kept saying, dude, something's pulling me back. Something's pulling me back. Dude, something's got me. And when he came out, he had where barbed wire had gotten him on the palm of his hand. And I don't know. I look at mine, and I don't see marks. But anyways, it formed like crosses. It formed crosses on both of his palms with the blood. But yeah, he was the one that got into the water. Well, he didn't get in the water tower, but he got inside the fence. And then the cops might have done a patrol around there, and I learned how to climb a tree really fast. And So even then it was, you know, that was again one of the legends that you start hearing as soon as you're a freshman.
It can be any experience, spooky, personal, like scary. It could be like anything you want. And you go back is when you're a little kid to now. So tell me a story like you had that you're like, oh man, that was, I remember that.
So there was, you know, when I was younger, I think a lot of younger people are afraid of ghosts and spooky stuff and stuff, you know, what was that sound that came from outside? And so I tended to be a little like, ooh, what's that, you know? And the house was that I grew up in, my parents' room was at one end of the house and mine was at the complete opposite end of the house.
Oh boy.
And there were a lot of doors in between.
Yeah.
And yeah. I grew up, I got up in the middle of the night one night to go to the bathroom and I had to walk through the family room and the kitchen to get to the bathroom. And off of that kitchen, straight line, we had a laundry room. The lights were off. There was a light on in the kitchen. Mom and dad always left the stove light on or something. And I heard footsteps from the family room or from the laundry room.
Yeah, right, right.
I could see directly into that room and there was no one there. There was nothing in there. It wasn't so dark that I couldn't see. And I heard distinct footsteps and a dragging sound. And I was I'm thinking about 13 at the time, 13, 14, the most. Right.
Yeah.
I suddenly did not have to go to the bathroom. And I ran back to my bedroom and got in bed and was terrified of whatever that footstep dragging sound was.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I remember just being scared to death about it.
Yeah.
And then in high school, we had for a creative writing class, we had to write a true story. And I wrote about this story and my teacher gave me a bad grade on it, which pissed me off because she said it wasn't believable. Right.
What?
She said,
come on.
Why wouldn't I have gone to wake up my parents to tell me, to tell them about it? And I was like, who wakes up their parents when they're that old?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
you take things, like I said, you don't take things seriously, but you've had some pretty cool adventures. Do you want to talk about any of those to my spooky friends, especially being locked up in a jail? You're just talking about, right? Now, so, she didn't do anything. Chelsea didn't do anything. All right. Let me make that clear. She did this on purpose.
They locked me down. They finally caught me.
That's a different take, people.
Yeah. My friends and I had decided that we wanted to investigate and kind of have our own experiences. And I thought it'd be great for the show to be able to speak about my personal experiences as well. So now I've been to an investigation at the Missouri State Penitentiary. Also been to the Squirrel Cage Jail here in Iowa. And that one we stayed the entire night and had some really, really cool interactions there.
And let's give the spooky friends a little tease. What kind of, name one interaction at the Squirrel Jail in Iowa that you had that really didn't really shake you, but kind of made you like, ooh, okay, what the hell was that?
I'll give you my best one that I had there.
Love it.
So, I had gone to use the restroom. There's one working restroom in the jail. I love that my story's starting out that way. But so I was off on my own and my friends were on the total opposite side of the jail. And I was washing my hands. And as I'm kind of scrubbing and I'm looking down, I watch as the faucet turns by itself and the water shuts off.
Nice.
And I was like,
oh my goodness.
Okay. All great.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And why don't you start and cover your cryptid?
All right. So today I've decided to cover the Pukwudgie. I got interested in the Pukwudgie 4 years ago. I didn't even know that they existed. I was actually listening to Lore, the podcast. So he talked about the Pukwudgie in one of like his first season episodes or something. And I was like, what is that? Like, I've never heard of that. So since then, I've been like super intrigued. So I decided that I wanted to tell a story, something probably a little different from what we've probably heard about the Pukwudgie and even maybe some Native American lore, because as you'll see, this mythology is Native American. So I'll be reading I hope you like it. So the word Pukwudgie stems from the Native American tongue. The lore is associated with the Algonquin, the Ojibwe, and the Wampanoag tribes, among others. The root Bagwaj or Bagwaji actually means wilderness or wild. And so the native word is actually Bagwajinini, which then translates to a little person or a person of the woods or the wilderness or the wild. Mm-hmm. So if you really think about it, the word Bagwajinini kind of sounds like Pukwudgie, which is actually where it stems from. Sure. So the Native American word is Bagwajinini. Pukwudgie is like the way that us Native Americans came and we just modernized it or made it ours.
Sure.
So Pukwudgies are typically described as small creatures who dwell in the forest. They're about knee high to 3 feet tall. Their faces are somewhat human-like. They've been described with front-facing eyes. They tend to have like larger noses. Sometimes they're described with like long ears or pointy ears. Kind of reminds me of like a troll or a goblin.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, troll. Gotcha.
Yeah. Their skin oftentimes is kind of gray, maybe smooth, or they'll have fur on them. And if not, even porcupine quills, which is kind of creepy.
Oh, that's interesting.
And weird. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But they walk on two legs. So you won't see them on four. You'll see them on two.
Okay, got two legs. Gotcha.
Yeah. So according to the Native American lore, these creatures have long existed in North America way before the settlers came in. And for a while, the Bagwajinini or the Pukwudgies lived actually in harmony with humans. Apparently that changed.
Uh-oh.
Yes. So one legend from the Wampanoag says that everything between the Bagwajinini and the humans was great until humans got distracted with their relationship with Mashup. Now, Mashup is a giant very benevolent creation or creator deity. And he is the person who was responsible for creating the Cape Cod area of Massachusetts.
Okay.
So it seems that Mashup was beloved by the humans, and the Pukwudgies kind of got a little jealous. So they became a little mischievous, you know, trying to get attention from the people. But this actually bothered the people and aggravated them. So they complained to Mashup and they said, hey, these Pukwudgies, they're bothering us. So Mashup was like, cool, okay, I'm going to take care of it. And he went and he scattered the Pukwudgies all through New England. Well, as you can think and probably determine that, you know, the Pukwudgies weren't very happy with that. So Mashup and his wife, who's known as Granny Squanet, left for a little bit. Okay. And as, in their absence, the Pukwudgies returned. But this time they returned with a vengeance because they were PO'd. They were PO'd. And so what app, instead of being mischievous and kind of just bothering people, they really took it up a notch. They started kidnapping children, burning villages. And yeah. And then apparently they even, you know, just outright killed people.
Okay. That is up a notch. Yes. And this is like the first level of ghosting, right? This is like the, we like ghosted them. We're like, hey, you know, Pukwudgies cool. We're, hey, why'd you return in my car? I'm a Pukwudgie. Let's go. What's going on here?
Yeah, they went from zero to psycho really quick. Ooh. So
reminds me of an ex-girlfriend. Yikes.
Oh, yeesh. So it turns out, you know, so Granny Squanet and Mashup find out that they're like basically killing the tribe's people, and they come back, and Mashup's like, don't worry, I got my five sons. They're gonna take care of the problem.
Okay.
Sends his five sons over. The five sons get lured and tricked because the Pukwudgies are tricksters. They get tricked by the Pukwudgies and lured into a trap where they all get shot dead basically by magical arrows.
Wow.
So at this point, Mashup is really PO'd and he's like, I'm going to do it myself. He goes to take care of the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, the Pukwudgies are like, we're smarter than you. And they lure Mashup to, I guess, this place in the woods where they shoot him with arrows. Now, the thing about the lore is it's not determined whether they kill Mashup or if Mashup just decides to, like, you know, turn it in, like, white flag, like, give up and leave. Because he doesn't show up back in the lore after that, apparently, from what I was gathering. So, it was pretty serious. Like, these Pukwudgies mean business.
Yeah. And
actually, So, translate that to today, Pukwudgies are actually still known to be tricksters. They're also known as killers. They lure you to the cliffs and push you off.
All right.
They shoot you with arrows, and they're known to also kidnap children. And they're shapeshifters, apparently. So they can shapeshift.
That is a heck of a combination. A shapeshifter, I can trick you. I'm smarter than you. I'm going to push you off a cliff, and then I'm going to shoot you with an arrow just to make sure you're dead. Okay.
No, and if that wasn't enough, apparently, when they kill you, they actually still have control of your spirit.
What?
No. So, like, it translates to the other side. Like, these things are ridiculous. Like, I'm just like, what?
Ridiculous.
Yeah, they're probably my favorite cryptid. It's just so crazy. So apparently, obviously, if you see one, you're supposed to leave it alone.
I had a paranormal experience at the age of 11, and it was so crazy to where. And I talk about that on the show also. That's probably the first episode. And that questioned everything going forward from that point. So I've always been, you know, looking and trying to dive into the paranormal just to see what, you know, that experience that I had, you know, and, you know, have others, you know, had those type of same things happen to them. And so, you know, throughout the years, I've always talked, you know, about the paranormal activities that go on in people's homes and the experiences that people have. And so, you know, that kind of prompted me, you know what, I need to start a podcast. And then so I went ahead and started this podcast, Strange Darkness Radio.
Nice. So I have to ask, Bobby, tell me a little bit. I know you probably have already said it to your audience, but I have a whole new audience here. Would love to hear your little paranormal experience at age 11.
Well, let me make this brief because it's kind of a little detailed. But all right, go ahead. Yeah.
Nice okay, teaser.
Exactly. Okay, a little teaser. Well, we were at the drive-in. We came back home. I really had to go to the restroom. Didn't want to, you know, find my way back to the car and all that jazz. So I waited, you know, until we got home. Me and my dad came to the door of our home. We entered the home. There was a glow, you know, a light that was coming from like the right side of the living room area. And as we entered, I tried to dart off and go to the restroom. And then as my dad, you know, saw whatever was happening in the kitchen, in the living room area, he told me to freeze, get out of the house. Somebody's in the house. And I was like, I need to go to the restroom. So I, you know, so being a kid, my first thought is, because my dad was in the military. And my first thought is, I got to go to the bathroom. So I'm, for whatever reason, I bypassed the hall bathroom to go to my parents' bathroom. I go down to the end of the hall. And as I look over to the right in my parents' bed, there is a long figure laying in the bed. And I froze. And then so as I look at this figure, I can, it's like, it was like a movie playing. I can hear my dad calling me, but I couldn't make out what he was saying as he was running down the hall. And as he puts his hand on my shoulder to grab me, the whatever figure was laying in the bed just totally went like into the bed. It just, the blankets were still disheveled. It just slowly just like, you know, just melted into the bed. And he's like, I told you to get out of the house and, you know, and everything. And what had happened was in the kitchen area, all the dishes were out of the cabinets. All of the food was out of the refrigerator. Ooh. It was, like somebody ransacked the house. And then as the police came, there was nobody that entered the home. They said someone must have entered the home and locked the door on the way out because there was no sign of any entries or anything. And so that was my, you know, first paranormal experience.
Wow. So I was talking about Tomes of Terror that I think had just come out to haunted bookstores and libraries, but I was saying, well, I'm working on haunted hospitals right now. And Rhonda Parrish and the co-author and I were working on this book. We got a call from a gentleman who wanted to share a story about a hospital he worked at, the Pinoca Institute in Alberta, Canada. And he had worked there for many years. It had been more than 10 years since he worked there. He retired now, but he wanted to share a story that he'd never shared before. And it was about a woman. So the chapter's called The Woman Possessed. And it was a woman who had lived most of her life in that hospital. She had no family. And she would get into bouts of violence where they'd take three or four people to hold her down because she had this superhuman strength that she could throw them off. She would scratch. She would bite. She'd be calm and fine and then just go right into this. Other things would happen with her room where she'd be complaining that her room was like a meat locker. It was so cold and freezing. They go in and there was nothing wrong with the heater. Everything was fine. So they move her into another vacant room. And, you know, when the minute they move her into the other room, the other room suddenly becomes a meat locker and the room she was in, it goes back to normal temperature. So weird stuff like that happened. They even had meetings. They did bring in priests. They thought they were wondering if she needed some sort of exorcism. But one of the nights where he was working by himself, there's a bunch of them doing an overnight shift and they've got the break room with the TV and stuff like that where they're hanging out when they're not doing their rounds. So it was his turn to go do some rounds. And as he's walking down the hall, he walks by a room and he hears voices because sometimes you'd hear her talking to someone else and you could actually hear another voice in the room. So he's like, oh my God, is there another patient in there? So he opens the room. It's pitch black. She's sleeping. There's no one else in the room with her, but she's sleeping while standing on the wall about four feet above the floor over top of her bed. She's completely horizontal. Her face is down. Her hair is hanging down over her face. Her body's like she's moving like she's breathing, like in her sleep. Mm-hmm. There's no one else in the room, and that's what he sees. He doesn't know what to do. He's kind of like, I don't know what to do. So he slowly backs up, closes the door, goes back to the TV room, and never says anything because he doesn't know, did he see something, whatever.
Yeah.
So he calls in and he tells the radio program this. So I'm working, I'm researching for haunted hospitals. What I do when someone tells me a story, I talk to the producer, ask George, you know, can I get the producer to find out who that was? Would they be willing to talk to me? Because I'd love to interview them for my... So lo and behold, a couple weeks later, I have a call with this person. Well, here's the interesting thing. One of his colleagues who worked there, who's also worked at the same hospital, recognized his voice, knew who he was, and asked to meet him. Tim Hortons is like a Dunkin' Donuts. It's a coffee shop chain here in Canada. I met at the local Timmy's. Yeah. Met at the local Timmy's, eh? And and the colleague told the story about one other night within that same year or two that happened to them, and they had walked by and heard her having a discussion with some other voice that was coming from the room that didn't sound like her. When they walked in, they saw her sleep standing vertically with her feet about a foot off the floor, facing, you know, she had her eyes closed and everything, and she was just kind of sleep standing, not looking at, but looking straight. And again, that colleague didn't tell anyone because they didn't know what to do. It was so unbelievable. They backed out of the story. The only reason they confessed, it was because they heard the story and they said, oh my God, I saw something. Well, I didn't see the exact same thing, but I saw something very similar. And so that was like, that stuck with me. And I remember telling the story at a late night author event.
You want to go to paranormal site anywhere in the world?
Probably Petra in Jordan is my wants to go to place, because I've read about Jin allegedly being there. I've just, ever since I was a kid, I think I saw it in the third Indiana Jones movie. And I've always wanted to go there. There's a series on Netflix called Jin, and it's not great, but it's Jordanian, if I remember correctly. And the first episode is set there. And it just, I don't know, I just really, that's always kind of called to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And has there been a place, just really quickly, have you, and I don't know if you guys investigated all, or have you been to, where you've been to a place that shook you a little bit, or, you know, maybe you've been somewhere where, again, you heard about and wanted to check it out?
I walked past the Cecil Hotel once in downtown LA. And I didn't go inside, but just walking past it, man, it was like the Eye of Sauron. It felt like someone was rubbing your third eye with sandpaper. It was a very intense feeling just walking past it. I can't imagine actually going inside.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah, I hear you. So, Paul, same question. Bucket list, where you would like to go, paranormal.
Hoya Forest in Romania.
Oh, yes. Yeah, explain that to people who are not familiar with it. Can you give us like a brief idea? Because that is awesome.
Yeah, so it's this beautiful, I mean, Romania itself is a beautiful and much unloved country by the rest of Europe. It's often looked down upon as a former Soviet republic. But it's, you know, for anybody who loves the spooky, we're all entrenched in a bit of a love affair with Romania because of Dracula. And so the Hoya Forest is this incredibly atmospheric portion of land that is, some would say it is a thin veil between both sides, and it's supposed to be inhabited by numerous nefarious spirits from the other side who will often lead travelers to a disappearing or a sticky end. So I'd like to go with plenty of people. and make sure, first. Yeah. Well, and, you know, make sure I've done some cardio beforehand, so I can make sure I'm not the slowest person there, and keep an eye out for the bears that wander around there. But yeah, that would definitely be my, especially in Europe.
most of them are slam. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of poltergeistal activity.
Yeah, right.
This had none of that. It was so subtle, it was unbelievable. Anyway, he was basically nominated by his bishop for his diocese to take over. Each Catholic diocese needs to have at least one exorcist. And their exorcist in their diocese was retiring. So his bishop nominated him to take the place of the exorcist. So he had to go to Rome. He had to do some formal training. And he'd come back. And he said it was quite like, you know, there was no cause for it, really. It was kind of, he viewed it as just a, like, you know, a box ticking exercise.
Sure.
Anyway, he then got in touch with a woman who said, like, you know, can you come and bless the house? Which she often gets, where he as a priest said he'd often get.
Sure.
You know, requests for house blessings, things are going on.
Yeah.
When he turned up, this woman was acting really strange and he wasn't like sure. And he thought she was being abused by the partner. Mm. And he left anyway. And as he's walking down the street, the partner runs after him and the partner's being attacked by her.
Ooh.
And the partner says, like, she's, there's something in her. She needs like help. So he goes back and pays her a visit and he's convinced then, like, he can tell in her eyes she's like oppressed. She knows, I think she mentioned something. I can't even recall what it was because I'm getting to the point I'm getting to, as opposed to regaling this story. Long story short, he goes to the bishop to ask for permission to do an exorcism. The bishop denies it and says a confession is as good as an exorcism. And he argues the toss. Why have you put me through the exorcism training then? Then... The bishop, like, outright, it's more or less a paper, it's a admin exercise. He basically says, I can't authorize an exorcism without her having confession. Mm-hmm. So he goes, well, I'm not going to get her in a confessional booth. But he said, will you give her one more try? So he does. He invites her around to the priest's house or the parochial home for tea. And she turns up, he hears the gate go. She's walking up the thing with a pram. She's got a youngster with her, about maybe 4 months old, whatever. Yeah. And she comes in, she sits down, all nice as pie. He goes, you want a cup of tea? Yeah, all good. Goes in, makes a cup of tea, comes in with a tray with some biscuits on and stuff like that. And as he looks up, she's holding the baby above her head, above his glass coffee table, and smiling at the priest and saying, what would you do? Sort of thing. What are you going to do? You know, can you stop me? Blah, blah, blah. He panics that much, he drops the tray. And then when he's picking the stuff up, she's back to herself and she's putting the baby back in the pram and she's like, are you okay, father? What's wrong? What's happened? And she's completely lost it. He goes, like, as in she's back to normal. She's lost the oppression, if you will. Yeah. So he then returns to the bishop and says, we are not getting her in a confessional booth. And the bishop says, my hands are tied. You know, you can't do it without. So he says, I can't do it then. I can't, you give me a job I can't do and I want to give him a notice sort of thing. Yeah. So only the Pope can approve you being lay-sized, apparently. Mm. So I'm learning all this through reading the letter or reading the email even.
Yeah.
So the Pope, the bishop writes a full explanation as to what's going on. The bishop immediately grants him being lay-sized. Which is suspicious in itself. It's kind of like, you know, no questions asked. Anyway, so he's but the weird thing is, apparently once a priest, always a priest. It's not like if he wanted to become a priest again, he has to go through the training again. He could literally just make a phone call and say, put me back on, and he's on. And he can also perform certain, like, last rites in an emergency and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway. As I'm halfway through this story, as you've heard, like, I do it in a different sort of accent, a little bit more serious.
Yeah, right.
A little bit more well-spoken. I'm really concentrating on what I'm doing. I become convinced that someone stood behind that curtain that separates my recording room to the door. Mm-hmm. So much so to the point that I stop recording. I take my earphones off and I say hello like 3 times.
Sure.
Then I put my earphones back on. I start recording again. Then I hear my name Then I take my headphones off and I'm like, someone's definitely behind that curtain. So like on a cartoon,
yeah,
I've got my umbrella and I'm poking the curtain from like my seating position.
Yeah. I gotcha.
But honest to God, something was in that room. It's not left me now, even now. And I've spoke about this numerous times on numerous versions of me numerous shows, that this was something that there was something in that
experiences. But while we've been talking, has anything entered your mind that you recall that has again, anything really spooky that you can remember?
Well, I did someone's apartment, and her daughter would not sleep in her room, and she's like 10 years old. And I'm like trying to figure out, why won't she sleep in her room? Yeah. And they lived there like 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she still won't sleep in her room. So I went there, did an investigation, and the second I walked into the mom's room,
mm-hmm,
I felt bad energy, especially in the closet.
Okay.
And then when I walked into the daughter's room, immediately I saw a demonic creature crouching down on the daughter's bookshelf where all her stuffed animals were sitting.
Oh.
There's like a space between the stuffed animals, and that's where they were sitting.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. When you say demonic,
it was, interesting.
Yeah. How do you know it was demonic?
Because of the way it was, the eyes, the red eyes, and the way it was shaped, the way it was looking at me, its energy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked in the closet, and there was a tall man in there crouching.
Oh.
It wasn't really crouching. He was just kind of bent over.
Yeah.
Under the shelf, standing up.
So I'm going to start by saying that I don't think all ghosts or spirit entities need to be ejected from the home. No. Some of them want to be there because it's their home too, or they're your family. And maybe not necessarily like the family you know, maybe they're an ancestor or a spirit guide. So in those cases, I think it's totally fine if they share space with you. You just have to learn to be okay with them.
Okay.
Now, that's not always the case. So I'm going to mention, I'm going to tell the story of a woman who I helped clear her space. Okay. And some people call this a house blessing. Some people call it a space clearing, whatever works for you. So I got to her space and she was having incredible anxiety every time she came home. She felt like she was being watched. So I got into her space and I immediately felt like, yucky, something's yucky here. And there was it was a beautiful old apartment, great old building. So I'm not a medium, but sometimes I can hear. Sometimes I can be clairaudient. And I could immediately hear the spirit in her house.
Yeah.
I said, does the name George mean anything to you? And she said, yeah, that was the man who lived here before me. And I said, oh, guess what? He's still here.
Oh.
And So George was still there. And George was a total creeper. And he was watching her sleep and bathe and go to the bathroom. Ooh. And she said she felt like people didn't really want to come to her home. And there were just, right. I mean, her pet was uncomfortable. Sure. There was every sign of an entity who really was just not the best. So I was able to interact with George. We did clear the space physically. There are several ways to do that. You can use bells, you can use sage or other herbs to burn. Like I said, there's lots of ways to go about it. And, I helped her figure out how she would maintain her boundaries in the space clearing situation. And, George agreed to leave, but I asked him if he would actually leave the whole building because it was a building of all women.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a space that was just all apartments for women and female identifying people. And I was just like, George, it'd be really great if you could find somewhere else to be besides watching these ladies sleep and undress. So George was not ready to cross over into a new life. He was kind of a miserable spirit. And in his case, I could clairaudiently hear him. That's not always the case, but I'm really glad I could, because he definitely needed to go. He was not, he was sapping the energy of that woman very specifically, but probably also the building in general. Yeah. And because he had lived there, he felt entitled to the space. He felt like, I have every right to be here. I lived here too. And in fact, the curtains in her living room were hung by him during his physical life. Oh, wow. So yeah, he was just like, well, this is still my stuff. And I'm like, guess what? You can't use this anymore. You have to go. You know, what you're doing isn't right, and you know it. Like, you know you're invading on her privacy.
Did he ever get physically abusive? Any complaints about that?
No. Luckily, no. He was not the type of entity that was touching and or moving objects. He was either he didn't want to, or he was just a voyeur, maybe.
Gotcha.
But
yeah,
just kind of a voyeur. Dirty old guy. He was a voyeur. Let's leave it at that.
Kind of a dirty old